Students have started a new school year at a suburban Indianapolis middle school more than 2 months after a classroom shooting wounded a student.
On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest greeted Wednesday by newly drafted Indiana Pacers player L.S.A. Johnson and other athletes as they entered Noblesville West Middle School.
13-year-old Ella Whistler and science teacher Jason Seaman were among those returning for classes.
Rebecca Till,
a 13-year-old boy allegedly shot Whistler and Seaman after officials say he entered Seaman's classroom May 25th with two handguns. New security measures, including more surveillance and police officers, are in place at the school about 20 miles north of Indianapolis. A referendum on the November 6th ballot would provide Noblesville schools with more funding for school safety staff, equipment, and other purposes.
Democrats say a plan by Republican Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson to consolidate voting precincts in Lake County would suppress the vote in Democratic strongholds. The plan, presented Wednesday, eliminates 170 of the county's 523 precincts, including 54 in Gary, 33 in Hammond, and 14 in East Chicago. A 2017 state law required Lake County to develop a plan to consolidate voting precincts with fewer than 600 active voters, and when that didn't happen, the task fell to Lawson. Democratic Lake County Clerk Mike Brown told the Times that Lawson's plan hurts the county's north end and is, quote, unacceptable. Lawson's chief of staff, Brandon Clifton, said the plan puts polling places a little more than a mile from active voters and a quarter mile from public transportation.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The emergency manager who oversees the financially struggling Gary School District says only one of 33 shuttered schools has received an offer after being put up for sale. The Times reports that the city of Gary bid $100,000 for the Benjamin Franklin Elementary School property. Gary Community Schools Corp. emergency manager Peggy Hinckley says the only offer made during the initial round of bidding was about $1.3 million less than the initial asking price. Hinckley says no decision has been made on whether to accept the city's low bid. She goes on to say the district isn't in an emergency timeline and will, quote, let the process play out. A second bidding phase will end August 24th. The city hopes to use the property as part of a multi-use development and affordable housing in the area.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Visitors to the Indiana State Fair that begins Friday will encounter metal detectors at every pedestrian entrance. Fair spokeswoman Sharon Smith says metal detectors were installed in the fairgrounds Indiana Farmers Coliseum for the last Indy Fuel hockey season, and organizers decided to expand them to the rest of the fairgrounds. The Indianapolis Star reports metal detectors were first installed at selected gates last year. State Fair security began using wand metal detectors at some gates in 2016. The fair will run through August 19th.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana farmers will have to change the types of crops they sow, the timing of plantings, and adapt in other ways to the changing climate, according to a university report. Purdue University's Climate Change Resource Center released its latest report Tuesday on global warming's expected impact on Indiana. According to the report, the state will likely see heavier rainfall patterns, earlier springs, and hotter summers in the decades ahead. The report goes on to say wetter and warmer weather could lead to more weeds, pests, and diseases. Higher overnight temperatures could also lead to a decrease in corn production. Increased temperatures could also put farm workers at a higher risk and cause livestock heat stress. Farmers may need to plant earlier, use different varieties of crops, and install ventilation and cooling stations for livestock and workers. Tim Schultz, who operates Engelbrecht's Orchid in Evansville, said he's already struggled with the effects of increasing temperatures. The planting of new tree stock was delayed this year by heavy precipitation in early spring. He goes on to say those trees later saw unusually hot weather.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Students have started a new school year at a suburban Indianapolis middle school more than 2 months after a classroom shooting wounded a student and a teacher. Students and staff were greeted Wednesday by newly drafted Indiana Pacers player L.S.A. Johnson and other athletes as they entered Noblesville West Middle School. 13-year-old Ella Whistler and science teacher Jason Seaman were among those returning for classes. A 13-year-old boy allegedly shot Whistler and Seaman after officials say he entered Seaman's classroom May 25th with two handguns. New security measures, including more surveillance and police officers, are in place at the school about 20 miles north of Indianapolis. A referendum on the November 6th ballot would provide Noblesville schools with more funding for school safety staff, equipment, and other purposes.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A federal lawsuit accuses a conservative group of illegally sending unsolicited texts that appear to come from Indiana Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly's office. The suit, filed Friday on behalf of two Indiana residents, contends the Judicial Crisis Network sent texts to them and others suggesting they call Donnelly and urge him to support Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation. The suit says people who called the number the texts were sent from were connected with Donnelly's Washington office, quote, creating the impression they came from there. The plaintiffs allege the group violated federal law barring unsolicited texts sent by automated systems and Indiana law prohibiting sending misleading or inaccurate caller identification information. A spokeswoman for the group denied the lawsuit's allegations. A spokesman for Donnelly's campaign called the text, quote, underhanded.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Bedford's utility department says the city's water is safe to drink despite a hepatitis A outbreak in Lawrence County. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, the utility is responding to rumors about the water quality.
Hepatitis A is spread through fecal-oral means, and Lawrence County has 45 cases. That caused some residents to worry about whether drinking city water is safe, and rumors about contamination quickly spread online. Eric Flynn is superintendent of Bedford's water treatment plant. He says in addition to treating water with chlorine and ultraviolet light, the city tests its water four times a week for indicators of E. coli.
I think any of your municipal drinking water systems or any drinking water system in general that is disinfecting, you know, and doing the tests that are required by EPA and IDM, if anything, they err on the side of caution.
Flynn says there's a very small chance, if any, that hepatitis A could contaminate the water supply. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana-based manufacturer Cummins will recall around 500,000 vehicles to replace a faulty emissions control system component. The Environmental Protection Agency says it's the largest ever voluntary recall of medium to heavy-duty trucks. Cummins External Communications Director John Mills says the vehicles affected are primarily commercial.
So larger tractor trailers that you would see on the highway, for instance, to a little bit smaller vehicle.
Mills says affected drivers will be notified soon. He stresses the recall is in the best interest of customers and the environment.
We're going to do everything we can to minimize the impact on our customers as we move through the recall process.
The faulty component can emit excess nitrogen oxides, an air pollutant known for its potency and contribution to smog in the atmosphere. An earlier recall involved Cummins engines in Dodge pickup trucks and the Ram 500.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state is doing more to secure student testing. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports a new rule from the Department of Education aims to avoid more invalid scores and students retaking tests.
Some students in Ligoti will have to retake part of the I-STEP this fall. The state invalidated their scores earlier this year after some test questions were leaked. The state also invalidated 2017 test scores for students at a Gary Elementary School earlier this year. State Department of Education Director of Assessment Charity Flores says the department has made efforts to improve security training for test administrators, making it more interactive. But that's not all.
Another change that we've made related to test security and integrity is ensuring that all staff within a building receive appropriate training.
Previously, only staff who administer the tests received security and integrity training. The change is in response to untrained staff being involved in test security problems. The new requirements start this school year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Some Hoosiers who've fallen behind on mortgage payments can once again get help from the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the state's decision to reopen its hardest hit fund.
The hardest hit fund provides up to $30,000 for those who have fallen behind on their mortgage because they either lost their jobs or had wages cut. The money comes from federal funds. The state closed the program a year ago because it couldn't guarantee it could serve new applicants. Now, the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority says the program will remain open until the funds are spent. Eligible Hoosiers must be able to make their current month's mortgage payment. The hardest hit fund dollars are only meant to cover a past due balance. Homeowners only have to pay the state back if they sell their house for a profit within 10 years. More than 10,000 people statewide have taken advantage of the program. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Hoosier farmers looking for a boost in prices could get some relief if the Trump administration follows through with talks of approving year-round E15 ethanol sales. President Trump mentioned the possibility during a visit to Iowa last week. He said the administration is working on rolling back restrictions that ban higher ethanol blended gasoline during summer months. The federal government gave a waiver to E10 gasoline in 1992, but left E15 out. That's discouraged many gas stations from offering gasoline with higher blends of biofuels. E15 contains more ethanol than other fuel blends, and there are conflicting studies on whether or not the fuel is better or worse for the environment. Corey Harris is the manager for the public affairs of the Indiana Corn Growers Association. He says the policy shift could be positive for consumers. Harris says Hoosier farmers would benefit as well if the White House lifts the restrictions, but was unable to provide specifics.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Senator Todd Young says he's hopeful the Senate will vote next month on comprehensive opioid addiction treatment legislation. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Young met with local stakeholders to discuss ways to address the state's opioid crisis.
The U.S. Senate has some significant issues to tackle in August. Government funding and a Supreme Court nomination likely top the list. Senator Todd Young says he wants to see an opioid treatment package make it to the president, even with the focus on those other priorities.
Since this is a national crisis and broadly recognized as a national crisis in every community, every congressional district across the country, I'm optimistic.
Young told stakeholders he hopes CORCs, Comprehensive Opioid Recovery Centers, will be part of any legislative package.
Well, it's important that we have a one-stop shop so that when people are addicted, they don't have to go to multiple different providers in order to meet their various needs.
CORCs would combine services that include residential rehab, counseling, and job training all under one roof. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana-based engine manufacturer Cummins reached a quarterly revenue record this week of $6.1 billion, but its overall earnings will be impacted by ongoing trade disputes. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, the company says recent tariffs and increased commodity prices are costing them about $100 million.
About 80% of the equipment manufactured at Cummins' Seymour plant goes to global markets. That means the increasing list of tariffs the U.S. is placing on Chinese goods and vice versa is having a significant effect on the company. Director of External Communications, John Mills, says Cummins is still trying to figure out how to mitigate those costs.
When you look at what the tariffs are at the very, you know, basic level, it's a tax, and that tax will get passed down inevitably.
Cummins CEO Tom Linebarger wrote in a New York Times opinion piece last week that jobs in Seymour and other Cummins facilities across the country could be at stake if the tariffs continue. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Attorneys representing the Rose Comans, an Indianapolis family who lost 9 members in the Ride the Lux Branson boat accident, held a news conference Monday in Kansas City. The conference comes a day after relatives of the victims from Indianapolis filed a lawsuit against Ripley Entertainment claiming wrongful death, outrageous conduct, and negligence. Attorney Robert J. Mongaluzzi, representing the family, says the family wants to know more about why this happened. Mongaluzzi says that since 1999, there have been 42 deaths associated with duck boats. The family wants duck boats banned at their current configuration. Attorney Andrew Duffy says the entire industry was well aware of the fatal design flaws of the duck boats. The lawsuit, filed in federal court, seeks at least $100 million in damages for the estates of 3 of the 17 victims who died in the boating sinking. Mongaluzzi says additional lawsuits are coming.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The former Wabash County coroner faces a felony charge of official misconduct, accused of failing to complete proper documentation on more than 300 cases that came through her office. According to Indiana State Police Sergeant Tony Slocum, Carol Lynn Knowles, 66, of Wabash, was arrested Thursday after an investigation. Knowles was booked into the Wabash County Jail and released on bond. State police detectives received information Knowles failed to hand over numerous files to the current coroner. When detectives recovered those files from her home, they found they did not contain an official coroner's report. Coroner's reports, required by Indiana law, contain information about the investigation into the death, descriptions of the deceased person, their name, and property found with the body. Knowles served as the Wabash County coroner from 2008 through 2016.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More than 15% of families in Indiana struggle to afford enough food. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on findings of a new national report on food hardship.
For families with children in Indiana, the rate is even higher at nearly 19%. The Food Research and Action Center compiled the survey data, and Feeding Indiana's Hungry Executive Director, Emily Weikert-Bryan, says not much has changed.
Because the programs that exist to help people who have difficulty getting enough food for their families have been pretty static. They have not changed, and they're also countercyclical.
The higher the levels of poverty and underemployment, the higher the levels of enrollment in programs like SNAP. SNAP and other food assistance is up for renewal through the Farm Bill that is in a U.S. House Conference Committee. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
China isn't going to take trash from the U.S. anymore. Last year, the country announced it will no longer import America's contaminated recycling. And with nowhere to go, the question is, what becomes of all of that material? As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Teal reports, people in Indiana are searching for ways to prevent potential recyclables from ending up in a landfill.
For some folks in rural Johnson County, these drop-off bins were the only way they could recycle. But today, they're not there anymore. The county discontinued them July 31st. The recycling district couldn't afford to pay haulers to take them. Executive Director Jesse Biggerman says no one supervised the bins, so the recycling often got contaminated with things like greasy pizza boxes. Now that China won't take low-quality recycling, Biggerman says the material in bins like these isn't valuable anymore. And if no one wants it,
then unfortunately, those items will sit idle. And at some point, they will find their way, either contaminating, you know, the environment around them, or going back into a landfill.
Few recycling districts have had to stop service. But others have decided that, like China, they simply can't accept some items anymore. Greene County stopped taking glass, and Monroe County won't recycle plastic bags and shrink wrap. Eliza Pokrell is the community outreach coordinator for the Monroe County Solid Waste District.
There's too much, okay, and the recyclers who handle that do not want to deal with it because they don't have any place for it, and we don't have a vendor for it.
While the value of U.S. recycling is low, the cost to process it has gone up, and that cost gets passed down to Hoosiers. Brownstown, which has less than 3,000 people, is a bit luckier. it only had to increase its rates by 50 cents a month. But Clerk Treasurer David Willey says the town just raised them 2 years ago to get larger recycle bins.
The time before when we went to the carts, a lot of people, you know, didn't like that big of an increase.
Some of Indiana's recycling gets sorted here at Rumpke's Material Recovery Facility in Cincinnati, Ohio. Steve Sargent is the company's director of recycling. He says China's standards are much stricter than what the U.S. recycling industry is used to. No more than 0.5% of the material can be contaminated.
Can our industry hit that on a consistent basis? No, we can't.
So what's the solution? Sargent says U.S. consumers need to start treating recyclables less like trash and more like what they are, products. Take cardboard, for example. By itself, recycled cardboard is very valuable, especially with the rise of companies like Amazon. But Sargent says when that cardboard gets jumbled together with other things, it becomes dirt cheap mixed paper.
The value of mixed paper today on the index, which we sell against, is zero. Now, you can't make much money when you're selling 30% of your mix in a recycling plant at zero.
Sargent says he gets it. People want to recycle as much as they can. But when folks throw the wrong items in the bin, they risk sending more recyclables to the landfill. Sargent says the industry needs to find a better way to teach people what's recyclable and what's not.
You're going to see a much more standardized message, a very basic message. So we want plastic bottles and jugs, small mouth, large body. We don't want tubs, we don't want butter dishes, we don't want all this food packaging waste. That's the material that's been contaminating us.
And if Hoosiers can manage to keep their recyclables clean, there may be a silver lining here. Allison Mitchell is the executive director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition. She says with some improvements, Indiana could process this excess recycling right here. The issue then would become making sure there are markets that want it.
One really easy way to do that is just to support and purchase from manufacturers who use recycled content in their products.
Sargent says adapting to the China ban won't be cheap, but that Rumpke has invested too much not to give it a shot. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bike shop opened last month near downtown Indianapolis. It's operated out of a garage and run by a dozen kids from the neighborhood. Some see it as a tool to fight the root causes of violence. Some see something bigger, a chance to empower young people by finding and using their untapped talents. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dotlin spent some time in the garage to find out how it got started. The story starts with D'Armond Hargis from the nonprofit in charge of the shop.
We would sit out on the porch and you'd watch all these kids do tricks on the bikes. It'd be like just a big mass, like 20, 15 or 20 kids. I stopped them one day and they kind of looked at me strange, like, who is this old man want to ask us about bikes?
He stopped us and he asked us what we knew how to do about bikes. That's when he said, prove it. Then we proved it to him.
Asked him, what y'all think about starting a business? And they're like, well, we'll come back and talk to you. 2 weeks later, they said, hey, were you serious about that bike shop?
D'Armond Hargis was serious about the bike shop. It was open 1 week later. He started it through the nonprofit he works for, called The Learning Tree. He says they were confident because the idea came from an interest the kids already had. And some of them, like 14-year-old Alex Brown, are talented mechanics.
Yeah, I could do anything on a bike. Basically, I was little, then I just kept messing with them, then I figured stuff out.
When I was 10, I used to fix bikes in the neighborhood, in my backyard, like put inner tubes and tires on and fix their chains.
That's Jaden Holland, Alex's 14-year-old friend who works at the shop. 12 kids work here, ages 8 to 18. They come and go throughout the day, tinkering with old bike frames, helping each other out.
We sell bikes, repair bikes, tune-ups. Tune-ups are $100, which goes to pay a bike mechanic $35 for a tune-up. We're not too far from downtown. Harding is part of United Northwest neighborhood. Harding Street itself is the more lower income. I heard so many stories about entrepreneurs that I knew it was in the culture of people that lived around here. Just stories about people and opening up little shops on their garages.
On the day of the shop's grand opening, Chief of Police Brian Roach shows up. He got the police department to donate over 40 bikes that were going to be thrown away.
You probably won't find this in a paper that says, hey, how do you reduce violence in Indianapolis? Well, you start a bike shop with a bunch of kids, but that's exactly what you do. They're looking for something to do, right? And to be engaged in something.
It's better for you to have to be in the streets. You need a job. You need a job when you're like my age. I seen like people my age smoke weed, have guns, and they don't have jobs. We starting off in a garage, and we're making our way up, and we're showing how to get people off the streets in a black neighborhood. That's why I care about it.
Like Jaden, some kids told me they're working at the shop to stay out of trouble, but most of them say they're there to make money. I asked one of the youngest workers, the 10-year-old Floyd, how much he's going to make.
I think $4,000.
You're going to make $4,000?
Yeah.
Floyd, unfortunately, won't make that much. But the kids are making more than they would at a typical summer job, and their pay is based on the hours they work. Diamond says there's an important lesson here.
Money. When I was growing up, because I grew up low income, people didn't want to talk to me about money.
You know what consignment means? You want to know what it means? You should. So consignment is when somebody brings a piece of merchandise there and we sell it for them and we take a percentage of it. So we'll have merchandise and we'll still have money. So it's people contributing to our business, really. So you could, that's how you should explain it. All right. You got your talk ready for tomorrow?
Yeah.
All right.
The other thing is soft skills, how to approach a person. How to say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Sir, I'd like to tell you what the cost is. I'll give you a call back and follow through with that.
What's up? If you don't have your inner tube, it's 10. If you do have yours, it's 5.
One of the things that happens in the low-income part of the neighborhood, we forget what gifts and talents are there. So we don't invest enough money and social ties into that area.
While Diamond and I talk inside the house, Jaden comes in, taking a break from the garage.
A lot of adults stop by, right?
Yeah.
What did they say to you?
They asked about how we fix our bikes and how much are the, like, to get their tires fixed, their inner tubes and stuff, and patch-ups. And they asked about how can they help us raise money for our bike shop. And they donate stuff sometimes, like
bikes.
How does
that feel, Jaden? How does that feel for you?
That feels great to me. For people to actually stop by and buy bikes and donate. Feels good.
What I like about young people, they dream. You know, they have imagination. That gives you energy. It's life-giving and not life-taking.
When the bike shop get hired and we get our own shop, he's going to be running it.
He's the CEO.
Is that true?
Yep.
So how big do you want it to get?
Worldwide, yeah. Going to have different shops all around the world.
And how are you going to do that?
Just keep working hard.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Indiana State Senator Karen Talion.
We have with us in the studio State Senator Karen Talion from Northern Lake County and in Porter County to talk about some of the issues that she has been able to take advantage of and bring up to U.S. and Canadian officials recently. Basically, if you will, Karen, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
If you will, tell us a little bit about what the U.S. and the Canadian Midwestern legislators get together and talk about on a regular basis and how you've gotten involved in this organization.
Well, the conference, it's called the Conference of State Governments. It's a national organization, but they all so split into regional areas. So normally every year I attend the Midwestern States Conference of State Government meeting, which also includes several of the Canadian provinces. And we meet once a year in you know, sort of traveling places. Last year it was in Des Moines, and I belong, along with Senator Ed Charbonneau from from Valparaiso, I belong to a group called the U.S.-Canada Relations Committee. Mm-hmm. And last year when we were in Des Moines, we knew that NAFTA was being renegotiated. And so we had a committee, and I was a co-chair of that committee, to sort of keep track of what was going on with the NAFTA negotiations. And then the idea was that we would come back there here to this year's meeting, which was in Manitoba, and kind of report on what's going on. Well, little did we know that it would be the hottest topic going. And in the meantime, my co-chair, who was a Canadian legislator, was ousted in Ontario's recent elections. Mm. So I ended up being the chairman of this committee myself.
Well, congratulations.
Well, that, yeah.
This is maybe, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is a rather dubious honor, I would imagine. So I know that we're talking about NAFTA in terms of from President Donald Trump as being the worst trade deal ever made. Well, that sounds more like might be it's an exaggeration. I'm sure there have been worse trade deals than that, but we know that NAFTA has been a big benefit to everybody that's been involved over the years.
Well, and you know, the thing is that when you're looking at NAFTA, you know, NAFTA really has a couple of different aspects to it. I mean, there's our trade relationships with Mexico. And then there's our trade relationships with Canada. And I don't know if the listeners know this, but the U.S. trade, Canada is the United States' number one trade partner, more than anyone else, even China. And even in the Midwest, you know, even in Indiana, Canada is a big trade partner for the state of Indiana. And so it's very critical, you know, the Canadians especially were very aware of what's going on and were very, I can say, both upset and wondering what, you know, what was going on in the states. So
I would imagine that in light of all the comments that have been made about NAFTA, and now on top of all of that, we have the concern about the tariffs that are being levied by the United States against Canada and Mexico, that NAFTA and certainly the relationship that we here in Indiana, that you're helping represent, have with Canada is even more important than probably than ever before.
Well, and like I said, you know, Indiana and the Midwestern states have a lot of trade with Canada. In some of the Dakotas, Kansas, Nebraska, and Indiana, there are a lot of agriculture goods and cattle and that move back and forth across the border just the same way our car parts do. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think of that, but, you know, up in the Great Plains states, cattle move back and forth. They are born in one place, move to another feedlot to get fattened up, move to a different place for, you know, for packaging. And so there is a big trade with the Canadians on all of those things, not only agriculture goods, but also on manufactured goods.
In your talks with your colleagues, not only from the U.S., but also your Canadian counterparts when you were up in Manitoba, you've obviously had this to talk about, too, but I'm sure that you probably have to figure out some type of strategy that you feel you can do for your own part to help deal with what is being tossed out from Washington.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because sometimes as state legislators, you know, we sit around Indiana and say, oh, gee, look what the feds are doing. We don't like that. What can we as state legislators do about it? And I think the general feeling at this conference, and I'm talking Republican farmers from North Dakota and Democrat manufacturing senators from Northwest Indiana, we were all saying, look, the U.S.-Canadian trade is really important and we can't jeopardize this. So, you know, it was a bipartisan feeling that we have to be really careful. And, you know, when I say that there's a difference between the Canadians and the Mexican trade, you know, one of the things that's been pointed out is that for the most part, the U.S. and the Canadian industries and workers kind of play on the same playing field. Our wages are similar. You know, there's bilateral equal trade between the U.S. and Canada. I find that a lot of the problems that people express about NAFTA are really about the U.S. and Mexico relations, where, you know, where the wages are not what they are here, and where you get situations like what happened in Indianapolis with Carrier.
Yeah, I was going to mention that's the big point there, the fact that we've had an entire company decide to move all of their manufacturing south of the border because the labor costs are so much cheaper than they are in Indiana or even the United States for that matter. So certainly I can see why it comes up as a very serious question. It's the south border that really the real dispute, I suppose, over NAFTA kind of lies right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, there are some other issues with NAFTA and some of the problems that have emerged over the last 20 years, but you know, like how you settle disputes. But that's sort of a subset of problems. The biggest problem that we have, I think, is this wage discrepancy between, you know, the Canadian-U.S. group and the Mexico wage lower wages.
Mm-hmm. You had an opportunity, I understand, to while you're up in Manitoba, to talk with Canadian Minister for Natural Resources, Mr. Carr, and he had some interesting conversations. I know he actually, I had a chance, I'm sure, to talk a lot about what not only natural resources Canada offers, but the products that come from those natural resources. And you brought up one of your topics that you've kept a close eye on over the years, and that's the use of industrial hemp. Tell us how that conversation started and how it's kind of developed to this point.
Well, actually, it was really interesting and. I didn't really realize when I went in that the person that I was talking to, James Carr, is the Canadian federal minister of the Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. That would be like talking to one of United States cabinet members. I thought I was getting a provincial guy. This was the federal guy, and he asked to talk to me, I guess, because I was head of this NAFTA subcommittee. And it was really interesting because I think that, you know, I expected him to kind of grill me on the ins and outs of what the NAFTA negotiations were, but he didn't do that at all. What he really wanted was to get a kind of feel of where the American people were on this issue, and were the American people angry with Canada, and or, you know, how that was going. I think he wanted a more regional look at just exactly how Americans, mm-hmm. not in power, felt about U.S.-Canada relations. The hemp thing actually was a different discussion. You know, the Canadians are getting ready to expand marijuana use even further. But for the last 20 years, the Canadians have been doing research and development on industrial hemp, meaning the use of, you know, fiber for paper or fiber for materials, fiber for fabric or something to insert into concrete. They are so far ahead of us, Chris. They are 20 years worth of research and development. They are so far ahead of us on that issue. It's going to be hard for us to catch up. I understand that Purdue is looking to position itself at, you know, the ag department at Purdue, which mm-hmm. is nationally famous, is looking to position itself in that field. But I don't know that we're going to catch up with people who've been doing this for 20 years.
Well, and even with a 20-year head start, we know that the United States was not necessarily a leader in the use of industrial hemp. We're talking, you know, 60 years ago during World War II, but they were doing very well because a lot of products, including such commonplace things as rope, were coming from the hemp plants that were grown, and we know that over the years Indiana played a large role, at least in helping develop some of the products that they came out of that industrial hemp. So
exactly, and then we just sort of let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing, too, I want to be able to bring up while we have you here with us on Regionally Speaking is to talk a little Indiana Democratic Party politics. We know that as we approach just a matter of months away from the November 6th general election, we have, of course, a lot of attention being focused on the U.S. Senate race, where Senator Joe Donnelly is hoping to keep his seat in Washington. And then we have, of course, others that are other Democrats and other officials who are on the ballot as well, too. We know that they're keeping an eye on the polls, too. You're and yourself included on being on the list as well, too, of those running for re-election. What kind of polling information do you get hold of lately here that tells how the voters out there think about the candidates that are on the ballot?
That's a really interesting question. I'm glad you brought that up, Chris. We, you know, of course, in election years, we all do polling to see what is, you know, on the top priorities in the minds of the voters. You know, 2008, 2009, we had a big recession here, nationally, of course, and it hit Indiana hard. And at that time, the number one issue, you know, in voters' minds were jobs and the economy. Well, it's now 9-ish years later, and we have pretty much full employment. We've, you know, I talk to people. People are working. Things are going well, and yet when you ask the voters still, their number one concern is jobs and the economy. And I'm really, really sort of struggling to figure out, to kind of parse that and figure out exactly what do they mean by that. Are they worried about, I mean, maybe we've just been saying it for so long that that's our automatic response. But I get the feeling that people are worried about wages and the fact that wages are not necessarily keeping up with the inflation. And also about stability. I got that answer a few days ago from some workers that I talked to. They're worried that, you know, given the tariffs, given the trade wars that are being, you know, that are going on in Washington right now, they're worried about the stability of their jobs. But I really would like to hear more from local people. As to exactly what they mean when they say they're worried about jobs and the economy.
Do you think that perhaps that maybe what they're referring to or they're using certainly as an example is the vast changes that have happened in the workplace by technology? For example, we have fewer people that have to run the steel mills than there were 20 years ago. When you used to have a full complement of hundreds of people on shift, you don't have to have that many now. There are a lot of jobs that technology has basically completely changed around, and that in turn has made it we know that the state officials are, and even the governor has talked about this too. I know that about workforce development. How do you get people trained for the jobs of the 21st century? Do you think that maybe that their concerns are kind of blended in with that too, but they're bringing it on a local basis there?
Well, I that may be part of it. I was at a workforce conference a few days ago in Indianapolis, and you know, we talked about the number of jobs that are left unfilled in Indiana right now that people aren't trained for and they can't get jobs. And then we're also talking about training people who are maybe in lower wage jobs to sort of move up into higher paying jobs if they get training and a little more education. But some of the low wage jobs, service jobs, janitorial jobs, working in retail. You know, we have a huge number of retail workers that don't get paid, that get paid well below what we call living wage. It's higher than minimum wage, but it's not a wage that will support a family. There are always going to be those jobs. People, you know, so we need to attack this from both sectors. We need to look at, you know, moving people who are able to get a little more education, moving them up into higher paid jobs. But we also need to take care of the people, and they're always going to be service sector jobs. We need to take care of them as well by making sure that their wages are enough to support a family.
So you get this impression that's what one of the, basically one of the things, if not the number one thing that is on people's minds here in Northwest Indiana, among other things, is focusing on that. And so these other issues that get passed around in the national marketplace don't count as much as apparently jobs and stability and security.
I think that's right. Well, here's another. So the number two highest polling issue was education, good education, K through 12. And yet, and we, you know, spend a lot of money on that in Indiana. And yet, about 3 or 4 months ago, they came out, there's a national organization that does National Educational Statistics Association. There really are organizations with names like that. They came out with a study that they had done over the last 15 years looking at how teachers' salaries are keeping up with inflation. Indiana, unfortunately, is number 50. So I can see that, you know, yeah, they have a job, but their wages aren't progressing to keep up with inflation. And so they, you know, in relative terms, they may be worse off than they were 15 years ago.
Well, we have more polls, of course, to come out before now and November 6th, so I'm sure we'll find more. I hope we have to have a chance to have you back on to talk about these issues again, too. And we appreciate you coming in today to talk more here about the concerns of U.S. and Canadian trade and the products that come across the border in both sides of the border, for that matter, too, and the opportunity to go to Manitoba and talk to people in Canada about the issues and express your concerns, certainly for Americans, to the folks in Canada that things are not as bleak, that we have some hope ahead, and that if you're looking to at least continue the talks and get these questions resolved about trade issues and the like between the U.S. and Canada. We've been talking with State Senator Karen Talion, who's a representative, Democrat lawmaker from Northwest Indiana, and with us to talk about these issues. And thank you for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.